You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Used to be, you didn't think twice about opening the faucet, filling up a glass of water, brushing your teeth, filling the kettle. The Flint water crisis showed us clean drinking water is not something that we can take for granted. And it hasn't stopped with Flint. Latest water samples put St. Clair Shores on the growing list of Michigan communities with high levels of lead. Other areas in our state are worrying about PFAS contamination in their groundwater. And it is no surprise to author Seth Siegel, his new book, Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink. Seth Siegel, pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy. Great to be on your show. And thank you for your leadership on covering water stories in a field in which very few people do.
Well, we certainly learned from the coverage that Michigan Radio did of the Flint water crisis. You know, we talk about water problems, and that does... It tends to be on the forefront of people's minds. As Flint unfolded, were you surprised?
I was surprised mostly by the fact that people were surprised, if I can put it that way, because it's quite clear that whether it's lead or PFAS or other contaminants, most everybody's drinking water in the United States has contaminants in them. And my issue, as you know from my book, is not about any one specific system, although I think we have to address it system by system. My problem is that we have a broken water program in the United States. The EPA is asleep at the switch. Our individual utilities are some doing a good job, but in the main, they are not.
And I want to have us talk about some of those factors. Just hearkening to Flint, what lessons should we take away from what happened in Flint? What do you see as the do's and the don'ts?
Well, the first thing you want to do is, and unfortunately, people got motivated only when they thought their careers were coming to an end or they might be going to jail. But the first thing you need to do is you need to start being honest about the testing. We need to use more technology. We need to be on top of problems so that we can address them before they become a crisis. The nice thing about water problems are almost always that they give you a long warning signal before they burst into your face. Whether it's a water main that breaks, whether it's PFAS, whether it's lead in the water, any one of these things, almost all of them are predictable based upon conditions at hand. And therefore, that's what I said, that what surprised me most about Flint was that people were surprised.
And we saw, for example, during 2015 into 2016, you had all the presidential candidates making their way to Flint. You had a lot of national media attention in Flint. And that isn't happening anymore. But people in Flint are still lining up to get bottled water. And I wonder, do you think the lessons that we should have taken away from Flint have been heard? Are they being applied elsewhere in the country?
I think it's hit or miss from what I can tell. I speak to lots of public officials. I speak to communities all around the country. I think that sometimes you have either enlightened public officials or you sometimes have frightened public officials who don't want to be the next poster child for bad governance. But frankly, no, I don't think it's enough. I think that we don't yet have a national conversation about water. And it's really a shame because drinking water in the United States is the most significant and least discussed public health threat of our time. And it's all the more tragic because we can fix the problem with existing technology and at affordable prices. And I think that that is the scandal that we have in front of us.
And certainly as well as lead, here in Michigan, and as we see in your book, Troubled Water, across the country, communities are discovering groundwater contaminated by that family of chemicals, commonly known as PFAS. What do you think, Seth Siegel, the eventual scope of PFAS contamination is going to be for our country?
Well, it's hard to say definitively, but the early signs are that it's going to be a real national problem because just in the last couple of days in New Jersey, they came up with results that basically all of the public utilities there were forced by state law, not by federal law, to do PFAS testing. And guess what? At 517 out of something like 517 of them that were tested, they found PFAS contamination.
What are the big challenges that we face in not only identifying, but cleaning up PFAS sites? I mean, the nature of that chemical makes it awfully durable.
Yeah, but the way to treat it is not to treat it by digging out all these groundwater sites and purifying them. The cost of that would be unimaginably gigantic. And there's no way that the corporations and the federal government, where they were liable for the contamination, are going to take that kind of responsibility. So the answer has to be at treatment and filtration, either if not at the source, then before it gets into people's homes. And so, and that's basically the plan that I lay out in Troubled Water, is that we have the means for doing this. Before the water gets, as the water gets drawn out of the groundwater, you filter it through very inexpensive, basically, filtration devices, GAC it's called, and then you clean the water of all the PFAS that are getting into people's water right now and threatening their health. For those of your listeners who don't know the consequences, PFAS just sounds like, you know, something mm-hmm. out of a laboratory, but it has real-world consequences. As I talk about in detail in my book, and tragically, it results in cases of kidney cancer, testicular cancer, ulcerative colitis. Women who are pregnant have very dire consequences from health effects when they have high PFAS in their bodies. And what's not made clear, I think, enough, is the fact that PFAS is a chemical that doesn't just come and then go. It comes and it's just like lead. It stays in your body and it has a durable, long-term bioaccumulative effect. Very, very frightening.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with author Seth Siegel about America's drinking water crisis. His latest book is Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink. You know, in talking about the Flint water crisis, Seth, and similar issues in D.C., you point out how the actions of a few individuals made a big difference. But all through your book, you show us that these water issues are massive and the result of a huge array of different factors, from the EPA to state and local governments, massive corporations. And it makes individuals' actions kind of seem like a drop in the bucket overall. I mean, is there anything individual people can actually do to make a difference?
Well, I think that's exactly why I wrote the book. I didn't write the book just to sell books or to tell a story. I wrote the book really as a cry for action by individual citizens. And what I have discovered, and I report on this a bit in the book, is that every time there has been a significant step forward in drinking water quality and safety, every single time, it comes about as a result of consumers, ordinary folks, becoming frightened about what comes out of their tap and demanding better. And that goes back to 1912, when there was the very first federal water law passed, to as recently as our laws, the Safe Drinking Water Act. When citizens become engaged, when they demand better, there is a result. And the good news, as I said earlier, is that this is a problem that can actually go away. How many other environmental or public health crises that we have can we say definitively that we know that we can fix the problem? This is one that can be fixed.
We certainly saw that in Flint. Citizen activists who didn't take the state's reassurances there's nothing wrong with the water and went to, for example, Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech and took it on themselves. So, yes, we certainly saw that play out.
But we also see the fact that whether it's the EPA or whether it's most of the time state authorities or public or sometimes even private utilities, is that nobody is taking it seriously, because the concept is it's legal. It's legal. We're following the regulations and the laws as set forth. But the problem is, and here's the mantra that we need to say to everybody, is that legal does not mean that it's safe. Let me share with you what I think is among the most compelling statistics. There are about 120,000 chemicals of different kinds, pharmaceuticals, plastics, industrial solvents, and so forth, that are in commerce on a daily basis in the United States. 120,000. So you would think that an intelligent system would be regulating or supervising or testing or monitoring, oh, I don't know, 3/4 of them, 90% of them, half of them, something like that, right?
Right, right.
Right. Okay, so the actual number, there are 70 chemicals that are regulated by the EPA right now. And if that number itself doesn't make you crazy, because it made me crazy, and it was that fact that got me to start researching that became the book, the second fact is the one that absolutely tipped me into saying, okay, I'm not going to devote a couple of years of my life to getting this story told. And the second figure is the last time the EPA regulated any chemical was 23 years ago. So explain to me, explain to anybody how it's possible that in an industrial society like ours, where every year there are 3,000 to 5,000 new chemicals or pharmaceutical products being added, many of which get into our water flow, that we haven't found a single one that's a threat, including, by the way, PFAS.
And you dig into the ways the EPA is caught in you portray this tug of war between public health and economic growth. Talk to us more about that.
Well, it's not even economic growth. I wish it were as simple as that, because then I could actually find myself saying, well, okay, I buy into the idea of economic growth. It isn't economic growth. That's traditionally the way the environmental debate is framed, right? Whether it's, you know, it's better for the environment or better for industry. That's really not the story here. The story here is that you have an unwieldy, huge, crazy, proliferated number of public water utilities or general utilities in the United States. We should have about 200 to 300 utilities to manage all of the drinking water in the United States. That would be a sane, manageable number. Instead, we have, hold on to this, you're not going to believe this, we have 51,535 separate drinking water utilities in the United States, plus another about 107,000 separate water systems. We'll put those aside for a second, because those are like universities, churches, campgrounds. Put those aside, even though those are regulated as well.
Sure.
But you have 51,000 plus utilities. Most of them are too small, too underfunded to do what they have to do. And because of this gigantic number of utilities, there's almost no way that the EPA can regulate them all. But the big problem becomes, and this becomes a bipartisan failure, we think of this as partisan, but it's not, it's bipartisan, is what happens is whether Democratic or Republican, you have all these small towns and some larger towns, and even within Los Angeles County, you have 200 drinking water utilities. And what happens is the congressperson comes home for the weekend, and because people aren't yet saying to them, I want my drinking water to be made clean, safe, healthy, and assure that I can drink it without any threat, they're not the ones talking to the congresspeople. The ones talking to the congresspeople are the utility owners or the public utilities themselves. And so they say, don't burden us with new regulation. Keep the EPA off our back. So what we have is we have a system where we have these 70 regulated chemicals, 91 contaminants altogether regulated, but that's all there is. And the utilities do not want to see new ones regulated. And we have a second problem, which is that we know for a fact that amongst those 70 that are regulated, some of them are not being regulated at the right level. For example, arsenic, which is a big problem in many, many parts of the United States. The federal government, the EPA, regulates it at something called 10 parts per billion. I don't have to explain what that is. Just say it's a number.
Yeah.
The correct number, most scientists agree, should be somewhere between 3 parts per billion and 5 parts per billion. So how did we get to 10? The answer, and I set this out in my book, is it was a completely political decision. Everyone knew the science, but because so many extra utilities would be caught by going from 10 parts per billion down to 5 or 3, the Clinton administration made the decision, a Democratic administration, makes the decision on political grounds not to have to jam down a better, higher standard that would be more protective of public health. That, to my mind, is exactly what the problem is. The decision is not being made by scientists. The decision is being made by politicians who are trying to take the path of least resistance and not antagonizing the largest number of people possible.
And that's why regulations keep falling short.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk a little about solutions, Seth, especially considering Michigan, our access to the Great Lakes, and the many diverse rural and urban communities that we have in our state. What kind of solutions do you think could matter most to Michigan?
Well, what I think you need to start seeing is first of all, is a national mindset, because this breaks down to, there's obviously many parts of the problem, but it breaks down to three basic problems areas. Number one is that the manpower needed to run a modern, technologically sophisticated drinking water system is in disarray. We have an aging water workforce, and in many, many communities, they can't even attract a single engineer to come in to work there because they don't have enough money to pay them or it's too remote. So the first problem is manpower. The second problem is technologies. You have all kinds of great technologies that are now at hand and available, but now on the one side, the EPA doesn't demand that it be used necessarily. And on the other hand, again, these smaller utilities, of which there are tens of thousands, don't have the funds to fix and pick up the newest technologies. And the third part, which I think has gotten some publicity, is broken water mains. And we have about 1.1 million miles of water mains in the country. They are very aged. Last year, there were 240,000 water main breaks in America, leading to huge amounts of water losses, huge amounts of carbon fuels being wasted because that water had to be transported. And we need to fix all three of these parts. We need to have a better manpower. We need to have more technology. We need to fix our broken infrastructure. Now, some of that is particular to Michigan and the people who are listening to us right now, but mostly these are problems that are national in scope, and therefore I call upon a completely new approach to all of this. Number one is we should stop thinking about fixing our pipes in terms of fixing them all today. This is a 25 to 30 year project that can be financed over 50 to 75 years because pipes last a long time. Number two is if we could reduce the number of utilities that we have down to a manageable number, we'd be able to have the population large enough to hire engineers and to buy the technologies needed to fix the problems. And so by having a more financially, fiscally sound drinking water system, whether public utility or privately held, I'm completely agnostic as to which one, by having fewer of them, you can have a far better outcome for everybody.
What will it take to convince the policymakers and also the public?
I know exactly what the answer is. People have to get angry. People have to demand a change. And again, I will tell you that time after time in America, we see that this happens. I have a historical vignette to share with you. In 1962, a woman named Rachel Carson, who may be known to some of your listeners, wrote a book called Silent Spring. There actually wasn't an environmental movement yet. It was conservation organizations. They didn't exist in environmentalism yet. She writes the book. It becomes a significant book. People start talking about it. And the book was talking about pesticides, not about water. And people got agitated about this. In 8 years, without social media, in 8 years, we had our first Earth Day. First Earth Day. Now, why is that significant? In April 22nd, 1970, 40% of all Americans, students, homemakers, workers, retirees, 40% take time off from whatever they're doing to participate in one or more Earth Day activities. But one person who did not participate in those activities was a man named Richard Nixon, who at the time was president, who also instructed his White House staff that no one should participate in Earth Day activities. April 22nd, 1970. Okay. December 2nd, 1970. Listen, 8 months later, Richard Nixon, no one's idea of an environmentalist, but a smart politician, by executive order, creates the EPA. Now, that kind of energy comes from the fact that he saw where the public was going and he needed to get ahead of it. All of the special interests, all the utilities, all these congressmen and congresswomen who don't want to do anything to upset their friends will change on a dime as soon as your listeners start demanding change, because that's what has happened again and again and again with every passage of every Safer Drinking Water Act.
Seth Siegel, his new book is Troubled Water, What's Wrong with What We Drink. Seth, it was great talking with you. We want to thank you for spending time with us.
Cindy, thanks so much, and thank you for helping to spread the word about this, and thank you for your ongoing work in this important area of drinking water in America.